holding on a hay almond olive, about the middle of the almond wine begins our saga. We talked about that a sukkah has to be at least 10 tefachim tall, and we said we learned that from the fact that the oren plus the kapodas was 10 tefachim tall, and the shechinah rested above the kapodas, implying that it had to be, that the shechinah had to remain in a reshus of its own. So it could come down to our world, but it had to be above 10 tefachim. And therefore we see that 10 tefachim is a separate reshus, and therefore that gives us a basis for saying that a sukkah, which has mechitzas after all, should be at least 10 tefachim tall. So let's figure that out. How we know that the oren plus kaporis is 10 tefachim. Very appropriate also, you know, during the 9 days we're supposed to be learning Hilchos Beis Abchira, and here we go. We're going to be learning Hilchos Beis Abchira, a detail of how something in the Beis Mikdash was built. So Bishlema oren tisha. I understand how we know the oren was 9 tefachim tall. Dichtiv, also aron atzei shikim. The pasuk says they should make an oren out of shikim wood. Amasayim v'chetzi orkoi v'ama v'chetzi rochboi v'ama v'chetzi kemasoi. The length is 2.5 amas. The width is 1.5. The height is 1.5. We're following the opinion of the mayor over here that says that an amma consists of 6 tefachim, which we're going to talk about on Amud Beis. What about we have the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that says it's only 5? So we'll deal with that later. But right now we're going according to the mayor. So an amma and a half equals 9 tefachim. So ela kapodas tefach menolon. How do we know that the kapodas was 1 tefach in height? So the answer is the Tani Rav Chanina. The answer is based on what Rav Chanina teaches in a Braisa. Kol ha-kelim she'osa Moshe, all the kelim of the Mishkan that Moshe made, nosnam, behen Torah, midas orkan, umidas rochban, umidas kemosan. For each one of them, the Torah gives us a length, a width, and a height. Besides the Oren, you have the Shulchan as another example, the Mizbeach HaChitza, the Mizbeach HaPnimi. Kapodas, on the other hand, when it comes to the Kapodas, midas orko, umidas rochban nitna, midas kemosa le'nitna. The Torah tells us a length and a width. It tells us 2.5 by 1.5, same size as the Oren. It doesn't tell us a height. Now, it's actually not really so that all of the Kalim doesn't say a measurement. For example, the Menorah, it doesn't say a measurement. We learn that Chazal teach us, you find that you have it in the Gemara in Menachos and in other places, that it was 18 tefachim tall. It doesn't actually say so in so many words in the Pesukim. On the other hand, there are remozim to it, for one thing, it says v'zeh masa menorah and v'zeh is gematria 18, but the other explanation is what it means is, if the Torah is giving us one or two, is giving us some of the dimensions, then it gives us all of them. The menorah doesn't give us any in the first place, fine. The kiyar, it doesn't give any dimensions either. But when it's giving some of the dimensions, then usually it gives all of them, only by the kapodas doesn't mention only two of them and not the third. So, what is it? So you can go and learn it from the smallest of the kalim. And then we're going to say, once we find that what the size of the smallest of the kalim, then we're going to apply that to the kapodas as well. By the shulchan, the posuk says, you should make for it a frame, make for it a frame of a tefach height all around. Therefore, we're on Hayamud Bay, is about 2/3 of the way down the Amud. The smallest of the Kalim, it says the Misgeras was a tefach in height, therefore Malahalam tefach, Afkan tefach. Therefore, just as that Misgeras, that frame around the Shulchan, was a tefach in height, so we learn from that that the Kapodas was also a tefach in height. The question about that is, why are we learning Davka from the Misgeres, which is only a component of the Shulchan, V'neilach Mikalim Gufaihu? Why don't we learn from the Kalim themselves? You have the Shulchan, for example, is 2 amas tall. The Mizbeach HaZahav is also 2 amas tall. Why don't we learn from them and say that the Kapodas is much taller than that? And the answer is, the famous expression, Tafasta Merubah, Lo Tafasta, if you grab too much, you haven't grabbed anything, Tafasta Muat Tafasta. But if you only grab a little bit, then you've grabbed it. Meaning, Rashi says, if you have something like this, we need to learn from some kelim. So if you grab a hold, if you say the smallest one, then good. It has to be at least that. There's no way that it can be less than that. But you're going to argue, for example, and say we should learn from another kelim, which is 2 amas. So we're going to tell you, who says. You don't know whether that's the case. It might actually be the smaller one. So metaphorically, like in Basin, if you're going to be going and trying to grab more than the minimum of what the other guy is agreeing to, then he's going to tell you, you're a liar. You're not entitled to that much. So therefore, the same thing over here. If you say a tefach, then for sure it's a tefach. But if you start trying to argue more than that, then you're not really gonna have a solid proof that it means that. Tosfos on Amud Beis discusses the mechanism of tefasta merubah letefasta in a little more detail. Do we say that only when the upper limit is undefined? In other words, that you could always say there's something bigger. Do we say that rule only then, or do we say it even, for example, when you have, there's gotta be an upper limit? Here, obviously, there's gotta be an upper limit in the sense that the kapodes can't be taller than the Mishkan itself. The Mishkan itself, as we're gonna say later, is 10 amas tall. The Aron was saying it's a tefach and a half, an amma and a half tall, 9 tefachim. You're not gonna say, you can't say the kapodes is gonna be 100 amas tall, because it won't fit into the Mishkan. So do we say tefasta merubah where necessarily there is an upper limit, or do we only say that rule when there's not necessarily an upper limit? So Tosfos discusses that further on Amud Beis. Tosfos also discusses it in Yuma and in some other places where the Gemara brings this concept of tefasta merubah like tefasta. So you can't learn from the kalim because you have no reason to assume that it should be one kali as opposed to the other when once you're dealing with the larger kalim. Okay, so the question is, v'neilach mitzitz, why don't we instead learn from the tzitz? The Tanya, tzitz ha'yodomikim in tas shalzahav, the tzitz on the Kohen Gadol's forehead, was a golden plate. It was a flat plate made out of gold. The roch of Beis Etzbois, it was 2 etzbois wide. Now 2 etzbois is half of a tefach, because a tefach is 4 etzbois. Umukaf me'ozen la'ozen, it went around from one ear of the Kohen Gadol to the other. Because of all the Beis Shittin, and there were 2 lines of inscription on it, Yud K Milamata Bakodesh Lamed Milamata, above it said Yud K, below it said Kodesh Lamed, but Amar Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yosi, but Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yosi says no, it wasn't written on 2 lines. Anira Isid Beroimi, I saw it in Rome. The Gemara tells us in Me'ilah a story of how Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and Rav Elazar Rav Yosi went together to Rome to be mevatel a series of harsh gzeiros against the Yidden, that they're not allowed to do Bris Milah and keep Shabbos and so forth. And to make a long story short, while they were a shed helped them out over there by possessing the emperor's daughter, and then they went in and then cured her by telling the shed to leave, and the emperor was so grateful that he told them, you can go into my treasury and take whatever you want, and they found the document with the Xeda over there and ripped it up. The point is, the Gemara mentions that so once they were in the king's treasury, this was about 80 years or so after the Churban, give or take, 70 or 80 years after the Churban. So the Gemara mentions in a few places that Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yosi says that I saw things from the Bais Mikdash there in Rome. So he says, I saw the tzitz in Rome, the kosovol of Kodesh Lashem b'shadachas. It said on Kodesh Lashem, all in one line. The point is, in other words, that the tzitz was only 2 etzbois wide. Why aren't we learning from that? So the answer is done in klimi kli, but ain't done in klimi tachshit. The answer is, well, we're going to learn a keli from another keli, rather than the tzitz is not really a keli. The tzitz is a tachshit, an ornament. It's something that a person wears, so that's a different classification of things. We're trying to find the kapurus, which is not worn, it's a keli, so therefore we need to compare it to another keli. A few things on this about the tzitz. First of all, when the Gemara says Yud K Milamaila, and on the faith, the way the Gemara has it written out, you would actually say Yud and then Hey. Or you're allowed to say that. We know you're not allowed to do that with the 4-letter name of Hashem, which is why we say, for example, Yud K Vav K. So Tosfos says that actually it's true the name Yud and Hey is a name of Hashem together, but nevertheless, the fact is it's not a complete name of Hashem, so therefore you would actually be allowed to. Nevertheless, the many people have the minhag, like we're doing now, to say Yud K over there also. The Noda Yehuda, in fact, talks about when it comes to L'Shem Yichud. He's Bechlal against the whole idea of saying L'Shem Yichud anyway. He has a in that famous Shuvah, he has something very sharp to say against it. Go open the door with your hands. One second. Um, So, but in that shuvah, the Nodeb Yehuda actually talks about this question: when you're saying, and before Baruch Shama or wherever else you say L'Shem Yichud, can you say can you say it with Hayes? And he says, actually, in principle, you could, because you're saying a Bez there in between. You're saying Yud, and then Hey, Vav, and then Hey. So in principle, you would be allowed to. Nevertheless, the meaning of the Velt is not to do that. Anyway, that's one thing. As far as this question of how the inscription on the tzitz was, so first of all, so you have this, you have the Tanakhama is saying Kodesh Lamed Milamata and Yud Kei Vav Kei with Lamaila. So Tosfos discusses over here, Tosfos discusses in other places, many other Rishonim discuss how exactly, according to that opinion, was it arranged? Is it that you had one possibility based on Yerushalmi is that actually you had the words Kodesh Lamed are in the middle on bottom and directly above them, centered above them, is the word Yud Kei Vav Kei. So Tosfos says, but come on, you don't read it that way. You know, you read the first line and the second line, so then it wouldn't be read properly that way. So they talk about that what it means is that Kodesh Lamed is at the beginning of the bottom line and then Hashem is at the end of the top line. In fact, some of the Choshim say the idea is you have on the stones of the Ephod and of the Choshim have the names of the Shvatim on them. So therefore, in effect, what you're doing is you're reading from the bottom up. You're reading the names of for example, Reuven, Kodesh Lashem, Shimon, Kodesh Lashem, and so forth. So like you're going from the bottom up. There are a number of other opinions among Rishonim how it was arranged, and one interesting one is that actually when we say over here Lamaila and Lamata, we do mean that the word Kodesh Lamed was at the end, what we mean is it was at the end of the first line, and then the name Hashem was at the beginning of the second line. So that way, it's still respectful that way you still don't have something else on top of Hashem's name, but on the other hand, it reads in order, the end of the first line, and then the beginning of the second line. The Rambam Bechlal has a slightly different shita anyway. Apparently he had a different girsa in the Gemara because he has Kodesh Milamata and La Hashem Milamayla. So he put the Lamed together with the name Hashem. This that we're saying that Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi says that I saw the tzitz in Rome and it had only one line on it. Now the other Chachamim still don't agree with him. They say, nevertheless, fine, you saw tzitz. That doesn't necessarily prove anything. How is that? I mean, on the base of it, he saw tzitz. There is a sicha where it ever talks about that in Bechlal, when do we say that we use a discovery like that to determine something in halacha and when not? The gist of it is, the Rebbe explains that the Rambam paskins that even though it was normally written on two lines, sometimes they wrote it on one line to accommodate Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Yossi's opinion. So the verdict is, in other words, that either way is kosher. The one that Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Yossi saw in Rome happened to be one that was written in one line. But l'tchila, that I'm not saying it should be written in two lines. That particular, and the idea is, in other words, it may be. So the Rebbe goes on to explain, actually, as far as that, as far as the Menorah, as far as the other Kalim, it's very possible that, you think about it, the Jews wouldn't have wanted the Romans are going to capture the actual Kalim of the Beis Hamikdash. They may well have made replicas in order to fool them. But after all, the replica has to resemble the original somehow. So if the tzitz was never written with the inscription on one line, and they found, and then the Romans capture one that has the inscription on one line, they're right away going to know it's not the real thing and continue looking for the real thing. Necessarily, we must say that there were times that it is kosher to write it on one line, and that sometimes they actually did that, such that now some Roman or some person who's informing the Romans, such as Josephus or whatever, would have occasionally seen the Kohen Gadol wearing it with one line, and he would have told them, okay, in that case, what you found. There's a good chance that this is a genuine item. That's the gist of it. It's a longer and very interesting sicha about, in general, what do we do? When do we accept archaeological discoveries and other such discoveries in determining what the halacha should be, and when do we not? Okay. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara. So we can't learn from the tzitz because the tzitz is a tachshit. We're looking for a keli that we want to learn from. What we're trying to learn is the height of the kapodos. That we said the kapodos is a tefach in height, so we need to know that. So the question is, v'nelach mizer, why instead of learning, so we're saying we're learning from the misgeres, from the frame that was around the shulchan, which was a tefach in height, the pasuk says. Instead, why don't we learn from the zer, from the ornamental border that was above, there were three kalim in the mismikdash that had it, we learned in Yuma, the order in the shulchan and the mizbeach hazav.
So and that Dhammamar is Zer Masha, when we learn in Yuma that the Zer was only a little thing. It only stuck up a little bit above the edge. So then you would say that the Kaporis could be very thin. The answer is done in Klimi Kliva and done in Klima Hashakli. The answer is we're going to learn one Kali from another Kali. We're not going to learn from something that's used to make that's used as a decoration for Kali. The Zer is only a decoration. It's not the actual Kali itself. So the question is, Yehachim Misgeres Nami Hechshakli who knew, and the Misgeres, the frame of the Shulchan, is also only a Hechshakli. And the answer is it's not because Misgarta Lamata Hosa, because it was underneath. It was, you had the legs of the Shulchan, the four legs, and then you have at the top of them is this Misgeres, and only on top of that do you place the slab of the table. So therefore, the Misgeres is not really. So therefore the Misgeres is more of a functional thing to hold the Shulchan together, to hold the legs together. So the question is, as opposed to the Zer, which is only decorative. So the question is, fine, that works out according to the opinion that the Misgeres was just that. It was underneath the slab of the table. It went from one leg to another to hold the legs together. So then you can say it's an important part of a cave. But you have a different opinion in Menachos that instead the Misgeres was on top of the slab. So according to that opinion, you have the four legs of the table without anything particular to hold them together. Then you have the slab, and above the slab, you had sticking up around the edges of it was a Misgeres that was a tefach in height. So according to that, the Misgeres is not really essential for the Shulchan. It's more in the nature of a decoration. It's not like it was needed in order for the Lachem Aponim not to fall off or something, because for that you'd have the Zer. So Ma'ik Lamema, then what are you going to say? Hai Hechsher Klihu. According to that, it comes out it was only a decoration. Tosfos has a very long discussion over here, as you can see, about the question, if we say that the Misgeres was on bottom, do we mean, like Rashi is saying over here, that the Misgeres attached one leg to another, like you have nowadays on tables, where you have like there's a rung or something that attached that goes from one leg of a table to the next, or from one leg of a chair to the next, to hold them together, and then on top of that would be the slab of the table, or is it more that the slab itself had a rim around it, which there you have a machloikas, whether that rim is right side up or upside down. And Tosfos gets into a bit of discussion about the pros and cons of that, and says that the more logical explanation based on our Gemara over here seems to be like Rashi, because if you say that it was attached to the tabletop, then you're back to the question. It's not hechsher kli, it's only a decoration. Whereas if you say that it was a rung that went from one leg to the other, then it's functional, and then we can learn from it. So if you're gonna say that the Misgeres was on top, then it's not serving a function. It's only basically decorative. So my ikalamema. Then what are you gonna say? Hi hechsher klihu. Now you're talking about something which is again only a decoration. And if you're gonna learn from that, you might as well learn from the zer, which is a lot smaller, and say that the kapodes was only the thickness of the zer. No. Ella, rather, we're going to answer like this. It's not a question of functional or not. Dunin Dabba Shinosna by Torah Midah, Midabba Shinosna by Torah Midah. We're going to learn something that the Torah gives a measurement from something else that the Torah gave a measurement. The Kaporis, we said the Torah gave two out of its dimension, the length and the width. We're only missing the height. So we're going to learn from something else where the Torah gives a dimension, namely this Misgeres, where it says it was a tefach. The al yechichu tzitz v'zer, as opposed to the tzitz and the zer, shem lo nosna v'han Torah midaklau, the Torah shebichsav at least, does not give a measurement for them at all. The zer, it doesn't say a specific amount, it stuck up a little bit. The tzitz, we said, was two etzbos, but Tosfos says over here that might only be drabonon. Because they would learn it from the fact that the pasuk says that it should be on his meitzach, on his forehead. The average forehead is about two etzbos in width. So in other words, what it might be, Tosfos also gets into a discussion, was it actually on his forehead, meaning below his hairline, or was it actually above his hairline? That gets into the question of where he placed that relative to where he placed his tefillin, because we talk about the mitznefes of the Kohen Gadol, that it was shaped somewhat differently than that of the Kohen Hediot in order to allow room for the tzitz as well as the tefillin, so all that factors into it. Anyway, the idea would be, so when we say d'rabbanan, in other words, that midoraisa, maybe there would be no specific size for the tzitz. Maybe it would be individually sized to the Kohen Gadol's forehead. Some people have foreheads that are taller than two etzbaos, after all. But midrabbanan, they set a fixed thing, two etzbaos. So, but in any case, it doesn't say that. In Torah Shabbat, so if we're going to learn the dimensions of the kapodos, then we're going to learn it from something that it says in Torah Shabbat. So therefore, so we're left with that the kapodos was a tefach, and then bringing that back to the earlier discussion, then we said if the oron is 9 tefachim and the kapodos is a tefach in height, then there you go, you have 10 tefachim, and there is a source that a sukkah has to be 10 tefachim tall, because just as we find that the shechina rested above the kapodos, meaning in a reshus of its own, the same way a sukkah which has mechitzes has to be a reshus of its own of 10 tefachim. Okay, that's all one way of learning it. Rav Huna Amar Mehocha. Rav Huna says, I have a different way of learning that the kapodos was a tefach in thickness. The pasuk says, when the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur and is sprinkling the blood of the various korbanos, it says, Al pnei ha-kapodos kedma. He should be sprinkling on the face of the kapodos toward the east. The ein ponim pochas mitefach. The definition of the word ponim is at least a tefach, therefore we see that the kapodos had to be a tefach in thickness. The point is, so Rashi says the expression that the face of a person is not less than a tefach. Now, what does that mean? The Aruch Laner says it can't mean a baby's face, because in fact, we see a baby is born, if you measure his face, it won't necessarily be even a tefach in size. So evidently, it must be talking about an adult's face, but then what do you mean? An adult's face is a lot larger than a tefach. So he says, because we find, for example, in the halachas where you have where a person is missing and you find his body and you need to figure out whether it's him in order to be matched or his wife. So we say that you have to look at parts of ponim in achotim. You have to be able to see whether you recognize him based on his forehead and his eyes and his nose. So we see that only that, from the forehead until the bottom of the nose, is considered ponim for that purpose in halacha. And that, in the average person, approximates a tefach. In fact, we said if the average forehead is 2 tefachim, then from there from the top of the eyebrows until the bottom of the nose is not 2 tefachim, 2 etzbaos, I meant from the top of the eyebrows till the bottom of the nose is approximately the same distance as from the top of the hairline until the eyebrows, and therefore you have approximately a tefach. And even fine, you have some people have larger faces and some have smaller ones, but it's never less than a tefach. So the question is, who says we're talking about a human face at all? The Eime Ka'afe de Bar Yuchni. Maybe say that we're talking about the face of a Bar Yuchni, which is a very gigantic bird. We learned about it in Yuma as well, where the Gemara was discussing when we say that a Kabeitza is the size for Tumas Eichlin, that how do we know it doesn't mean the size of a Beitz of a Bar Yuchni? What a Bar Yuchni is, it's hard to be sure. Maybe it means an ostrich. Maybe it means some bird even larger than an ostrich. There are a couple of kinds of extinct birds that lived in various places that were even larger than an ostrich. So yeah. So their eggs would be pretty big, and the face of such a bird would be very big also. Rashi brings from a Gemara in Bechoris that tells a story of how one time a Bar Yuchni's egg fell out of the nest and drowned a bunch of cities. And okay, it's meant as a guzma, but still the point, and it's meant as a mushal, and Marsha and other Mephoshim explain what the nimshal is, but nevertheless, in other words, you wouldn't use, for purposes of the mushal, you wouldn't use, for example, let's say that a chicken's egg or a robin's egg or something fell out and did that. You would use, for purposes of the mushal, a very large egg. So the Bar Yochanan itself is a very large bird. Its face is a lot bigger than a tefach. Maybe the comparison is to that. And again, the answer is tefasta merubala, tefasta, tefasta mua, tefasta. Same answer as before, that if you try to grab too much, you're not going to end up with anything. Meaning, in that case, you could say indefinitely, you could keep on getting to larger and larger creatures, and you're never going to have any upper limit. And there's never any, or according to Rashi, not even that. If you try to say the face of a Bar Yochni, yeah, but who says? Maybe it's a smaller kind of creature's face. Whereas when you say a person's face, there's a logical reason to base itself on a person. Because after all, as we're going to say soon, the Kruvim had human faces. So the Gemara had thought maybe we should compare it to a bird, because after all, they had wings, so they had bodies like birds, but the faces were like faces of people. Now, the question is then, but still, how do you know? Maybe it still could be a bird. So maybe it means to say the size of the face of a tzipauto, which is a small kind of bird, which is very small, far smaller than a tefach. And again, given that the Kruvim had bodies of birds, maybe after all, you should compare it to a bird. So Omer of Achba Yaakov, Rav Huna Pnei Gomer. What it is Rav Huna, when he's learning that it should be a tepach because of the word ponim, he's actually learning from a gzeda shava on the word pnei. Ksiv hacha el pnei akapodes, uchtibas ameis pnei Yitzchak avi. So therefore, so Yitzchak being an adult, his face, as we said, by definition, the definition of a face, meaning down to the bottom of his nose, is a tepach. Therefore, that's what we're basing ourselves on. Whereas it never says anywhere in the pasuk, it never uses the word pnei in connection with a bird. Therefore, we have no reason to compare it to a bird. Not a bar yochni and not a tzipauta. We're comparing it to a human being. So the question is, in that case, if we're going to learn from the word pnei by Exeter Shava, the neilach mi ponim shomayla, why don't we instead learn from the faces of the malachim? Many times what we have is, we have a concept, einonim don Exeter Shava me'atme. A person can't come up with Exeter Shava on their own. But sometimes we have that the Exeter Shava was given what words to be used, but not what particular locations those words are in. And that's left up to the Tanner or the Amurda to figure out for himself. So fine. Rav Huna has the Kabbalah, there's a Gzeda Shava from the word Pnei. One of them we know is al Pnei HaKapodes. But where's the other one? Not necessarily was it given. So instead of learning it from Yitzchak, maybe instead we learn it from the Ponim of the Malachim, Dichtiv, as Yaakov says to Esav, Kir ois Pnei Elikim Batutzeni, that when you're willing to accept me and to forgive me, then it's like seeing the face of it, it's like seeing the face of a Malach. Where Rashi explains over there, by the way, that one reason why Yaakov phrased it that way, how do you compare the face of Esav to a Malach, is actually he wanted to hint to him, I've seen Malachim and even beaten them, and that would make Esav frightened. This guy got away with fighting against a Malach. I'm not gonna be able to sew it up with him. Anyway, the point is that he uses the word Pnei Elikim. So maybe say then that when Malachim appear in human form, like you have, for example, in Yechezkel and in Daniel and other places, then they appear as larger than life people. So therefore, their face also is going to be larger than a tepach. Maybe learn from that. And again, the answer is like before, tafasta. There's no reason to say it should be larger than a regular person's face. You're going to argue that. You don't have a basis for that. Especially if we say that that there's no upper limit to it, because again, how large is a Malach's face? It could be indefinitely large. So therefore we can't. Okay, so the question is, v'neilach mikruv, why instead do we not learn from the kruvim? And the Gemara assumes at this point that the faces of the kruvim are smaller. The Oruch HaNer says there's a logical reason. We're going to say soon that the kruvim themselves were 10 tefachim tall. Now, the average person, the Gemara tells us, is 3 amos tall, and 3 amos is 18 tefachim. There's a machlokes, Rashi and Tosfos, in a number of places, whether that means only from the shoulders to the ground, or whether it means from head to toe. But in any case, a person, the height of a person is around twice the height of the kruvim. So the Gemara is assuming at this point, if the kruvim are 10 tefachim tall, then their faces are proportionately smaller. So therefore, so in that case, why don't we learn from there? Dichtiv el kapodes yu pnei akruvim. It uses the word pnei over there also, that the faces of the kruvim face towards the kapodes. The answer is amar abach vayakruv gemiri in pnei kruvim chosim mitefach. As a matter of fact, we have the Kabbalah that no, the faces of the kruvim are not proportionally smaller; they are a tefach in size. Rav Huna nami mehacha gamer. In fact, Rav Huna is learning from there. He doesn't have to learn from Yaakov Avinu at all, or from Yitzchak Avinu at all. He's learning rather from what it says about the faces of the Kruvim, that we have the Kabbalah. They were a tefach. Now, when you think about it, the Gemara is going to say in a second that the faces of them were like faces of children. And when you look at the proportions of children versus adults, a child's head is a lot larger compared to their body than an adult. So you could well have that the kruvim are only 10 tefachim tall, and the face can still be a tefach. This face from forehead to the bottom of the nose can still be a tefach, like it would be like closer to the size that it would be in an adult, even though the rest of the body is smaller. So the Gemara says, my kruv. So what does the name kruv mean? The word kruv means like a child. The word ravya means a child. Shekin b'bavel, currently in yukar ravya. That's in bavel, the Aramaic word for a child is ravya. So therefore the kruvim are like a child, meaning they had child's faces. So the question, so there you go. But even as child spaces, their face was still a tefach in size. Or, I mean, conceivably also, we might say over here that now we mean the face, the whole face, meaning from the top, from forehead to chin. Maybe they were made smaller like that, because again, they're supposed to resemble children. So therefore, maybe the complete face was a tefach, not like we were saying before, only until the bottom of the nose. Anyway, so the point is that, yeah, so the Gzeira Shava actually does not have to come from Yitzchak Avinu. It can come from the Kruvim themselves, and that's better, after all, because the Kruvim are attached to the Kaporis. We're trying to figure out the height of the Kaporis. It makes more sense to learn from something that's attached to the Kaporis itself rather than from Yitzchak. Okay. So the question now is, Omalei Abaya, Elameata, by that logic, if you're telling me that the Kruvim had human faces, Dichtiv, Yechezkel describes when he sees the Merkava, he says, Pnei ha'echad pnei ha'kruv, the Malachim that he saw over there, the Chayes HaKodesh, he says, have four faces. The first face is the face of a kruv, or pnei ha'sheni pnei adam, and the second one is the face of a person, and then the other two are a lion and an eagle. By the way, in the Maisim Merkava that we read as the Haftarah on the first day Shavuos, which is the first perek of Yechezkel, he describes it a little bit differently. Instead of the face of a kruv, he describes that one of the faces is the face of an ox. So the Medrash says, it's Gemara and Chagiga, I think, that Yechezkel says to Hashem, the problem is an ox is a kateger, reminds us of a chet eagle. Swap it out. And so Hashem swapped it out for the face of a kruv, and therefore when he sees the Merkava the second time around, in Perek Yud, if it's safer, then instead he sees Pnei Kruv. But if you're telling me that a kruv has a human face, then Hainu Kruv, Hainu Adam, then it's the same thing. So the two of the faces are the same? And the answer is Afi Ravravi Afi Zutra. It means there was a larger face, an adult face, and there's a child's face. So they're both human, but different size faces. In Chassidus, it talks about the idea that Afi Rabrivi represents Chochmah of Hashem as it is Lamaila, before it comes down through Tzimtzumim and Seder Shtalshalus and all, and Afi Zutra refers to how it is after that. So both of those are represented in the Kruvim. Okay. Fine. So that's another way of learning that the Kaporis is a Tefach. So the bottom line is we have two ways of understanding that the Kaporis was a Tefach in thickness, and therefore once we add that to the height of the Odin, which is 9 Tefachim, then we have 10 Tefachim, and we say that above 10 Tefachim is a separate Rishus, and therefore that allows us to say that the same thing, a Sukkah has to be at least 10 Tefachim in height. But the question is, Umimai de Chalola Asora Bar Mischacha, how do you know that the interior space of the sukkah, the empty space from the floor to the schach, has to be 10 tefachim, Eima Bahabi Schacha? Maybe it means including the schach. After all, with the Oren and the Kaporis, that's how it was. The empty space inside the Oren was not 10 tefachim tall. Based on what we said, it was a lot less. You have the Kaporis itself as a tefachim thickness. In Yuma, we talked about how thick was the floor of the Oren. You have to subtract that also. So you have a lot less than 10. So you're right. Ela Midbeisei Lomim Gomer. Rather, you're right. We're not going to learn from the Oren. Rather, we're going to learn from a detail in the actual Beis Hamikdash, not in the Mishkan, but in the Beis Elamim, the Beis Hamikdash, which is so called because the Shekhinah is there Elamim forever. Which, by the way, Maharsha says, we're not completely abandoning the Limud from the Oren. I mean, we just spent a whole Amud learning from it. We're not going to completely abandon that. From that, we're going to learn that, for example, in other areas, not in Hilchos Sukkah, but, for example, in Hilchos Shabbos, we have, for example, you have a solid block, which is 10 tefachim tall and 4x4. Then it's considered a reshus. It's considered a reshus of its own. It's considered a reshus yachin. That we will learn from the Oren. But when we're talking about here, the sukkah, where we're not just concerned about the top surface of it, we're talking about the inside of it, there we're going to need a different limud. So we're going to learn it from a detail of the Beis Hamikdash. The Pasuk says, the house, the Beis Hamikdash that Shlomo built for Hashem, Shishim Amma Orkoi, the total length was 60 Amas. That means the Kodesh plus the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Kodesh was 40 Amas, the Kodesh HaKadoshim was 20. The Esrim Rochboi, the width was 20 Amas, or Shloshim Amma Kaimasai, and the height was 30 Amas. Uchtiv, and now you have, it describes over there how besides the kruvim on top of the Oren, Shlomo also made two large kruvim that stood on the floor made out of wood and plated with gold. And it describes, Koimas ha-kruva echad eseba amma, the height of the one kruv was 10 amas, v'chein ha-kruv ha-sheni, the second kruv was the same thing, 10 amas tall, v'tanya, and we learn in a b'raisa, So now the question is, so that tells us, in other words, so we see that the proportion was 1 to 3. The height of the Kruvim is 10 amos, and the total height of the Kodesh HaKadoshim is 30 amos. Tosfos actually mentions over here, now there is another pasuk that talks about the height of the Kodesh HaKadoshim being 20 amos. So in fact, the answer is that it means there was 20 amos of empty space above the Kruvim, as opposed to in other places, Rashi, in his Pirush on the Psukim over there in Malachim, Rashi explains that actually the Kodesh HaKadoshim was lower than the Kodesh. The Kodesh HaKadoshim, according to him, the Kodesh was 30 amos tall, and then the ceiling came down a little bit, turned 90 degrees downward, and then went to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the Kodesh HaKadoshim was only 20. Tosfos says, based on the Gemara over here, it comes out not like that. The ceiling is flush the whole way, 30 amos. Anyway, the Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Ma Matsinu Beveis Elomim Kruvim B'Shlish Abayis Einanim, just like in the Mishnah Keshden, the proportion was 1 to 3, the Kruvim take up the bottom third of the space in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and above them you have the remaining 2/3, the remaining 20 Amos is empty, Mishkan Nami Kruvim B'Shlish Abayis Einanim, then the Mishkan also, we don't know, the Pasuk doesn't tell us how tall the Kruvim were that were on the Aron, but we're going to derive from that there was the same proportion that the Kruvim in the Mishkan reached only until 1/3 the height of the Kodesh HaKadosh. So let's calculate. Mishkan Kamahava Eser Amos. How tall was the Mishkan? It was 10 Amos. Yichtiv Eser Amos Odech HaKodesh. It says that the height of each of the beams was 10 Amos, and that was the beams were placed vertically one next to the other, so the length of the beam equals the height of the Mishkan. So in terms of tfachim, how much does that come out? Shittin pushri, it comes out to 60 tfachim, because there are six tfachim to an amma. So tlos tilte kamahavi, a third of 60 is how much? Is esrim pushri, 20 tfachim. Dal asara the oren and the kaporis. Now we established before that the oren and the kaporis together took up 10 tfachim. Therefore, subtract those poshul lohu asara. Then you have another 10 tfachim left. The height of the wings of the kruvim then was 10 tfachim off the top of the kaporis. Ochtiv, and the pasuk says v'hoyu akruvim posif nafayim lemaila. The kruvim spread out their wings above. Seichachim b'chanfeim al kaporis. They covered the kaporis with their wings. So we see kari rachmona skochol lemaila ma'asara. So we see that the schach has to be seichachim has to be 10 tfachim above. In other words, you see there has to be 10 tfachim of empty space between the top of the kaporis and the bottom of the wings. So therefore, the same thing with the sukkah, the empty space. The interior space of the sukkah has to be 10 tefachim. So the question is, who says that their wings were above their heads? Maybe they're exactly flush with their heads. So if their heads are 10 tefachim off the kaparis, then the tops of the wings are also 10 tefachim off, and the wings have a thickness to them after all. So therefore, the empty space below them, between the kaparis and them, is less than 10. And we're back to our question, where a sukkah doesn't work that way. You have to have an interior space of 10. The answer is Amar of Achvayek of Lamailiksi. Yeah, but the pasuk says that their wings were above, implying above their heads. So now the question is the aim of the midli tshuva. Okay, maybe they were way above their heads, and then in that case you don't have a source for 10 tefachim. The answer is miksiv lamaila. It doesn't say way up; it just says up. So therefore, they were right above their heads. So their heads are at the 10 tefach mark. The tops of their heads are at the 10 tefach mark. Their wings are right above that. So therefore, they're covering a space of 10 tefachim, and there you go. That tzach has to cover a space of 10 tefachim. Okay. So now, so far, so good. But Hanichel Rav Meir, all this works out only according to Rav Meir, the Amakola Amos HaYavenenius, who says that all the Amos that were used for measuring in the Bais Mikdash were average size Amos of 6 tefachim. Now, why are we calling it average size? So Rashi explains like this. You have, there's a 5 tefach Amma, and even Rav Meir agrees that there were certain purposes for which they used a 5 tefach amma, in particular for certain parts of the Mizbeach HaChitzim were measured using that. Then you have, on the other hand, it says that the Gemara brings in Psachim and in some other places that there were measuring sticks above the eastern gate of the Har HaBayis. The eastern gate was called Shushan Avira because there was a picture of Shushan on it that the Gemara explains elsewhere that when the Kodesh and then Daryavesh gave permission to build the second Beis HaMikdash, they made them put that picture over there. So number one, they should remember where they came from, that they came from Golos, and number two, that they shouldn't rebel against the Persian kings. Lamaisa, in the end, 34 years after the second Beis HaMikdash was built, the Persian Empire collapsed anyhow, but the picture still stayed there. Anyway, the Gemara describes how in a room above that gate, there were two measuring sticks which were slightly larger than an Ahmah. And the Gemara explains over there those were meant when you're contracting with contractors to build or to make something, you would contract with them using the regular size amas, and they would deliver the finished product using the larger size ones, so there's no possibility of ne'ilah, so that they're not mistakenly, so they're not accidentally misusing property that belongs to Hekdesh. Anyway, the point is, therefore, six tefach amah is beninus. It's in between. It's between the five and these larger amas. So and Reb Meir holds that was used not only for the buildings of the Beis HaMikdash, but also for the Kelim. So therefore, according to him, then when we said before that the Arden is 9 Tfachim tall, then it fits. An Amma and a half equals 9 Tfachim. El Rabbi Yehuda, the Amma shall binyan shisha Tfachim, the shall Kelim chamisha. But Rabbi Yehuda holds that no, the Ammas that were used for the building were 6 Tefach Ammas, but the ones that were used for all the Kelim, he says, are 5 Tefach Ammas. My Ikal Memer. Then what are you going to say? How are you going to calculate as follows? Now if we recalculate, again, we're still going to follow the assumption that we said before that the kruvim extended upward until one third the height of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The calculation of the height of the Kodesh HaKadoshim is still the same, because they were talking about Binyan, and Rabbi Yehuda agrees that Binyan uses 6 tefach amas. So the height of the Kodesh HaKadoshim in the Mishkan is still 60 amas, it's still 60 tefachim. Therefore, the height until the top of the Kruvim has to be 20 Tvachim. But it means that the Arden was smaller. Arden v'kaperes kamahavila hu tman yopalga. It comes out, according to him, the Arden itself was an amma and a half, which according to him is 7.5 Tvachim. Add to that a tefach for the kaperes, you have 8.5. Poshalu chad ser yopalga. To reach 20 Tvachim, you need 11.5 Tvachim. So you're going to say, eima sukkah d'havi chad ser yopalga? You're going to tell me that a sukkah is kosher only if it's 11.5 amas tall? We never find any such opinion. So according to him, where were you learning the height of a sukkah from? And the answer is, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it's going to have to be necessarily that we learn it from a halacha l'moshe m'sinai. But there's no way to learn it from psukim, so therefore we have to learn it from a halacha l'moshe m'sinai. That a mechitza is defined as being only 10 tefachim tall, less than 10 tefachim, it's not a mechitza. The Amr of Chiyah Ba'ashi Amr Rav, Shi'urin Chatzitzin u'mechitzin halacha l'moshe m'sinai, The shiurim, which we're going to discuss now in the Gemara, the fact that the Torah tells us shiurim of various yisurim, a kezayis for many things, a keseves the size of a large date, that the minimum amount that a person is chayev for eating on Yom Kippur, etc., etc., all those kinds of shiurim, also chatzitzin, also the dinim of chatzitza, umechitzin, and the dinim of mechitzes, halacha l'moshe m'sinai, all those three things are halacha l'moshe m'sinai. And the definition of halacha l'moshe m'sinai is that there's nothing in psukim about it. So therefore, so according to the Yehuda, that's how it is. Why are we mentioning these three together? Later on in the Masechta, there's something where Rashi says, similarly, where it mentions three dinim together, Arava Nisachamayim and Esther Natias, Arava Nisachamayim. Rashi says they asked about all three of them in the Beis Medrash at the same time, and the answer was they're all halacha l'moshe m'sinai. The same thing would be over here. They asked in the Beis Medrash, where do we know shiurim from? Where do we know chatzitzin from? Where do we know mechitzin from? And the answer by all three was halacha l'moshe m'sinai. So therefore, the Gemara puts them together. So the Gemara asks, what do you mean shiurim daraisa ninu? What do you mean? The amounts of shiurim, the amounts that this thing has a shiur kezayis, this thing has a shiur of keseves and so forth, that we learn from a pasuk in Chumash. So then by definition, it's not halacha l'moshe m'sinai. Because halacha l'moshe m'sinai would mean that there's no source for it in a pasuk. The pasuk says, now, why does the Torah have to list those minim in particular when the Torah is already telling us that Eretz Yisrael is not lacking anything? So therefore, it must be that the Torah is coming us to tell us, this whole pasuk teaches us about shiurim. Namely, it's another praise of Eretz Yisrael. all the kinds of fruit that you need in order to measure various shiurim and halacha, you will find them right there in Eretz Yisrael. You don't need to import them from other countries. So that's a praise of Eretz Yisrael, as Moshe is continuing over there in the Pesukim. The whole pasuk is telling us each species in the pasuk is teaching us a different shiur. Namely, let's go through them. Chita labayis hamanuga. When we say wheat, what we mean is that we use wheat for a shiur as far as when a person goes into a house with tzaras. An interesting point over here with all of these that we're going to mention is, since we're saying that this is the shemach of Eretz Yisrael, maybe what that means is that we davka have to use the fruits of Eretz Yisrael when we're measuring this. After all, wheat grows in different sizes in different places. So it would be, in other words, the pasuk is implying that you need to use davka, the ones from Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so what do we mean by wheat? So like this, when a person goes into a house with tzaras, the rule is like this. When a person goes into a house with tzaras, he becomes tamei only if he stays there a certain minimum amount of time, do his clothes that he's wearing become tamei as well. So therefore, so the Tanan we learn in a Mishnah, hanichnas the bayis hamenuga. If a person goes into a house with tzaras, with kalev oksefav, if he's carrying clothing on his shoulders, the sandal of a taboisa biyado, or he's holding his sandals or his rings in his hands rather than wearing them, huvehent mein miyad, he becomes tamei right away, and so do they, because all of them came into the house not as clothing. But hayolavosh kalev, but if he's wearing his clothing, the sandal of beraglam, and he's wearing his sandals on his feet, the taboisa betzbaisa, and his rings are on his fingers, then hu tamei miyad, he still becomes tamei right away, behein tahorin, but they remain tahor, ad she yishe b'chdei achilas pras, until he remains there the time of k'dei achilas pras. Because the pasuk first says that if a person comes into the house, he becomes tamei, and then it says, then the pasuk says, if he lies down in the house, then his clothes become tamei, and if he eats in the house, then his clothes become tamei. So we learn that what it means is not that he actually has to eat or lie down over there. What it means is he stays in there long enough that you could eat a k'dei achilas, that he could eat a pras. The word pras actually means a half, because it means a half of a loaf of the size that the chachamim determine is the size for an eruv. So there's different opinions in the Gemara over there, whether it's the size of 6 or 8 eggs, so therefore pras would be the size of 3 or 4 eggs respectively. So the amount of time that it would take for a person to eat a pras, a half a loaf of bread, and what kind of bread do we mean? Pas chitin v'loi pas sodin. We mean wheat bread rather than barley bread. Mesav, and when he's reclining, v'oicha b'liftan, and when he eats it together with a condiment. Rashi explains that all those things are the chumra, because wheat bread, because it's tastier, you eat it faster than barley bread, and when you're reclining, you eat faster than when you're sitting up, and when you're eating it with a condiment, then it goes down faster. So according to Rashi, it comes out that we're being machmir. According to the Ritzvah, actually, it's the other way around. The Torah is telling us to be maple. It's wheat bread, which because it's tastier, you chew it for longer, you're reclining, so therefore you're eating it slower, you're eating liftan with it, so therefore not every bite is exclusively bread, so therefore it takes longer to finish the bread. Anyway, the point is that we're figuring out the time using wheat bread, and that's what chita in the pasuk represents that. In terms of what k'dei achilas pras is, in terms of minutes, the posts can have all over the place as far as numbers did, anywhere between about 2 and 15 minutes. The Alter Rebbe, for example, in one place says 6 minutes, and some Machzedek says in some place 8 minutes, or I think the other way around, actually. The Alter Rebbe says 8, but some Machzedek says 6, but then it's quoted in his name 7, and then you have different poskim that have more or less than that. And you even have an opinion, the Minchas Chinuch and some other Achronim say, maybe it's not a fixed amount, maybe it depends on the type of food. For example, you eat matzah on Pesach night. It takes a lot longer to eat dry matzah than we're saying over here, eating wheat bread together with liftan. So, yeah. Okay. Anyway, the point is that we use wheat in determining a measurement in halach. Next, sa'ora. Where do we use barley? The Tanan. We learn in a Mishnah, etzim kesa'ora, a grain of a piece of bone, of human bone, the size of a grain of barley, metame b'mago v'masa, it's metame a person by touching it or carrying it, ve'ena metame b'oil, it does not make a person tame if he's under the same roof with it, or if he overshadows it, or it overshadows him. For that you need a larger amount of bones. For that you need a spine or a skull or most of the bones in the body, etc. But an individual piece of bone the size of a grain of barley is matame a person by touching or carrying it. Next, Geffen, Kedei Revius Yayin Lanazir. The next one in the pasuk, Geffen, a grapevine, is the Revius of the Isurim of a Nazir. So what does that mean? Rashi explains like this. The Gemara, in Masecht and Nazir, the Gemara discusses over there, the Mishnah, and the Gemara discusses over there that we know that a Nazir is not allowed to drink wine, he's also not allowed to eat any grape product. And there are, in fact, opinions over there that even, for example, if you were to eat, for example, grape leaves, then those would count towards a shear to make him chayiv malchus. Now, so how do you figure out a revius of solids like that, like grape pits and leaves and so forth? What you do is you take a cup that holds more than a revius. You start putting these things in, and as you put them in, liquid spills out of the cup, and then eventually you measure and see whether you have a revius that spilled out. The point is, it actually says, now you could conceivably measure that using a cup of water, but water has less surface tension than wine. Water is thinner, so therefore if you fill up a cup of water, when it brims over at the top before it spills over, you're going to have less of a brim on top with water than you will with wine, because wine is thicker. So therefore, the way you measure this is dafka, you have to use a cup of wine and see whether a revius of wine spills out of the container. And then you know that the volume of these things, of these leaves and whatnot, equals a revius, and then you mechayev and malchus for that. So therefore, the Torah is telling you, measure it using wine, and specifically the Ritzvah says, what we mean is wine from Eretz Yisrael, like all these other things, rather than water. Now, elsewhere, Rashi has a different explanation, that it means that if a nazir drinks a revius of wine, then he's chayiv malchus. The Tosfos over here mentions that opinion, and mentions that explanation, and says, but that doesn't fit with all the other ones. All the other ones over here, we're using the thing as a shear. Here, we're not using it as a shear, we're just saying, if he drinks wine, he's chayiv malchus. And Tosfos gets into a long discussion about the pros and cons of that, and various other explanations of how you might measure this amount. And also, b'chlal, you have different opinions in the Mishnah and in the Gemara and Nazir over there, whether the amount that's mechayiv him is a kezayis or a revius, etc. Okay. Anyway, so that's what we learn from Geffen. Next, te'ena. What do we learn from a fig? Is kigurgeres leitzas Shabbos. When it comes to carrying on Shabbos, or actually a number of other malachas involving food on Shabbos, if a person does the size of a grigeres, the size of a dried fig, then he's chayev for carrying out on Shabbos. If a person carries less than that amount of food on Shabbos, then he's not chayev, a chakas, or skiller, or what have you. It's still osir, but it's still potter aval osir, but unless you have, the Mishnah describes over there, unless you have, he himself, let's say, is particularly storing away this food, he wants it for some particular purpose, so he considered it as important, even if it's less than a grigeres. But other than that, the average size would be, the typical size would be a grigeres. Next, remind what shiur has to do with a pomegranate. Ditznan kol clay balabatim shiur and kerimonim. All kalim of balabatim, meaning as opposed to ones where a person is going to sell them, they still remain. They're still makabel tuma until they develop the hole the size that a pomegranate will fall out of it. Because up until that point, it can still be considered a functional kalim. Only when it has a hole that large, only then is it not a functional keli anymore. As opposed to a keli that somebody wants to sell, or even a smaller hole with it is going to make it not makabel tuma, because who's going to want to buy it with a hole? You actually have the Tosfos refers to a Gemara in Shabbos that mentions there are actually various degrees in there when it becomes what happens to a keli as it develops larger and larger holes. But the bottom line is, you have over there that you're talking about when you have a keli that you usually keep pomegranates in, and then it develops a hole that size, then it's not makabel tuma anymore. A nafkamina of it nowadays is when it comes to building a mikveh, where you have certain cases where you might have something that could be considered a keli, and you have to make sure to begin with that it has a hole at least the size where pomegranates will fall out of it. For example, you have the Alter Rebbe came up with an invention of a kind of wooden box that before the Alter Rebbe's time didn't have heated mikvahs, so it was a real problem when women have to tovel in the freezing cold. So you have all those stories of in the olden days where people would break through the ice, but you know, yeah. So the Alter Rebbe came up with an idea of a box that with holes in it where you could fill up the box with hot water. You could put the box inside like a lake or something like that, and then have the water inside it will be heated up, But the box will never have been considered a keli. And one of the details is there that the box has a hole larger than motzi rimen, so that it was never considered a keli in the first place.
It was a wet cover.
So it had holes in it, and eventually, obviously, the hot water was not going to stay in it long term. But at least for the time being, it would be possible to tovel in it without freezing. Yeah. Okay. Next. So that's Riman. Next, when the pasuk continues, Eretz Zeis Shemen Udvash, the pasuk continues, a land that has olives that produce oil, that means Eretz Shekol Shirea Kazaisim. It means it's a land that all of its shirim, as far as that all of its shirim are kazais. We just said that there are ones that are based on wheat and barley and grapes and so forth. What do you mean all the shirim are olives? What we mean is most of the shirim. So for example, you know, chelev, dam, pigul, noiser, etc. Most isuri achila in the Torah involve that if a person eats a kazayas, then he's chayev, but not less than that. And also mitzvah. If a person eats matzah on Pesach, they have to eat at least a kazayas and so forth. Okay. And dvash means kakasevis agas. Dvash, which is honey, which means juice from dates. We're learning from that you have a person eats the size of a large date on Yom Kippur, then they're chayev for breaking Yom Kippur, but not less than that. We learned in Yuma, the idea is because the Chachamim figured out that only if a person eats that amount, only then does he not feel hungry anymore. It won't satisfy, won't fill him up, but at least it'll take the edge and he won't feel the inuri of Yom Kippur. Anyway, so we see that whole pasuk, all the shivas aminim, are used for shiurim. Therefore, we learn shiurim from a pasuk, so you can't call them halacha l'moshe b'sinai, because the definition of halacha l'moshe b'sinai is there's no pasuk for it. So alma daraisin, and you see that all these shiurim are daraisa. So the Gemara says v'tisbara. How do you actually think that that's what it means? Shiurim miksivi. After all, does it say in the pasuk anything about shiurim? We're doubtioning that it means about shiurim. And after all, it doesn't say which one is which. It doesn't say the chita is for bais hamenuga and the seora is for a grain of bone, etc. So therefore, ela hilchas aninu. What it means is they're all halacha l'mishmi sinai ukra asmachta ba'almahu. The pasuk is only an asmachta is a way to strengthen it, to help remember the shiurim, but not that we're actually necessarily learning them from the pasuk. And in fact, actually, the Gemara in Yuma tells us that they were halacha l'moshe b'sinai, and then according to one opinion, they were among the halachas that were forgotten during the 30 days of Avelus for Moshe Rabbeinu, and Othniel ben Knaz had to reconstruct them. So in connection with his reconstruction of them then, maybe he came up with this asmachta. Or there is actually the Ritva in Rosh Hashanah mentions the Chlal. When we say that something is asmachta, we don't mean, in other words, that the Chachamim are just randomly finding a pasuk. What it means is Hashem put it in the Torah to begin with. If the Chachamim should find it appropriate to make a certain gzera, then I'm leaving your pasuk over here that you can use as a basis for that gzera or that takana. So the same thing over here. We could say, in other words, that Hashem knew that it's going to happen. These halachas are going to be forgotten, and Othniel is going to need to reconstruct them. And therefore, we put in this pasuk that we can use now as an asmachta, as a basis for reconstructing them. But the actual shiurim themselves are halacha l'moshe b'sinai. Okay. We continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem.